Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. And we're back. Happy 2016 to everybody. This is episode 5, and we have read The Giving of Orders by Mary Parker Follett. Now, you may have noticed that there is no supplement to this episode. This is simply for logistical reasons, as we just didn't have the time to record one. However, Ralph wrote a fantastic episode introduction, which you can find on the website under the episode page. So if you ever wondered who Mary Parker Follett is, or why it's worth having an entire episode devoted to her, then that should answer all of your questions. For more information, go to www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. As always, we are grateful to the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick for their support. My name is Dimitris, speaking to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
This is Pedro, coming to you from Brasilia, Brazil's capital.
This is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the UK.
This is Ralph, coming to you from Norfolk, Virginia, in the United States, across the pond.
All right, welcome everybody.
Good to be here.
Hello.
How was your break?
Very nice. And I'm excited to be back.
Very busy in my case, moving.
Good, good.
It was good. Intense.
Very nice. I enjoyed mine as well. So apparently the text that we are looking at today, The Giving of Orders by Mary Parker Follett, is a lecture. At least that's what I gathered from reading it. Mary Parker Follett has been renowned for being a cross-disciplinary author, and this text, I think, is very exemplary of that, amongst other things. So what she's trying to do here is she observed writing at the height of scientific management of Taylor, which is episode 1 of the podcast, that managers would expect to give orders and would expect people to follow those without giving much consideration to what goes into the order or what it is in the first place. So she kind of tried to distance in this text from this traditional top-down model to something that she referred to as the law of the situation. And that's something I want to discuss in detail, because I don't really understand that, but I think the basic idea of this work is that instead of giving people sometimes derogatory top-down commands, everyone should sort of work together and follow the proverbial situation in making a decision as to how to organize and perform tasks and things like that.
Yes, she recognized what she refers to as the holistic nature of the community and business, and she talked a lot about reciprocal relationships and understanding how power is conveyed and practiced in organizations and communities as well. And in her writing, she talks quite a bit about the principle of integration. And because it's a lecture, and she refers to other lectures, and she also talks about the limited time she has. She doesn't go into a lot of detail on that, but essentially, she's referring to the non-coercive use of power. And a simple way to think of that is power with rather than power over. And she's been called by many as a management guru, the mother of modern management. And it's interesting that she died in 1933, and it was in the build-up to World War II and a lot of heavy industrialization, and I would say maybe part two of the industrialization of modern Western economies, and therefore a lot of her ideas fell out of favor, and it's almost as if they didn't exist. And this lecture that she gave is a collected a set of works that some people who knew her at the time wanted to put together because they were afraid of losing her thoughts and ideas, or they would cease to exist. And to some extent, they did. So it's timely for us to be talking about this and these principles of integration and power with.
Great summary, guys. I think I just want to jump in and give a bit of the structure of the text. As Dimitris and Ralph said before, it is a lecture, so there is much more essay kind of feel to it. If I'm not mistaken, it was written on 1926. I'm not sure if that was when it was delivered or when the book was issued, but anyway, I think that's among those dates. And the text is very interesting because it starts with a call that she does for a reflective position, which is to say not necessarily to follow her ideas, but almost like an invitation for managers and leaders to reflect on what are the assumptions basing their the way that they do things at organizations, and to see if that is really what they want to go. So that's a very interesting way to set up, I would say, the hook for her text. And then it's divided in three sections, which are much more or less independent. First, she reflects on the giving of orders in relation to behavioral patterns, in this idea that she has that giving orders will not necessarily be they will not necessarily be followed if the person doesn't really has the habit linked to that. Then she talks about that what you guys said, which is exactly the logic of the situation, you know, the law of the situation. This idea that's not necessarily about giving direct control, but more creating the environment for people to feel that that's the right thing to do. And finally, she has a more open and one section that I found more hard to understand and pin down, which is about liberty and the giving of orders, in which she reflects more on this issue of power. And I think she talks about, you know, how this difficult dilemma of giving up and keeping control at the same time. So that was my general idea for the structure of the text.
I love how it starts. The first sentence of the text, I think, is very illustrative of the whole thing. The chief thing I have to say to you in this paper is that I wish we could all take a responsible attitude towards our experience. A conscious and responsible attitude. And I read it and I was like, wow, you don't see that every day? That's so good.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
That's very true. And I think much of management education today has a much more, I don't know, one right solution kind of approach. You know, even the great case studies are usually written. They try to inspire for one way to make sense of the situation. And she has a much more, how can I say, humanistic way of thinking that, you know, it's about developing your ability to be critical, to be reflective, not necessarily giving you a set of tools. So I found that was very, you know, inspiring and different.
Perhaps the word you're looking for is philosophical?
Well, I won't accept that, but let's say yes.
It's interesting because you talk about her kind of more inclusive approach to management principles, not those necessarily one size fits all, very prescriptive or normative. And I thought it's also on the first page, it struck me right away when she talks about principles. And these ideas are giving orders should be based on principles. And she recognizes immediately that her principles may be different than yours. And I think that goes back to what Dimitri was talking about, the responsible attitude. She said, you just need to make sure you're consistent with your principles and that you've thought through them, which I thought was very interesting because that's very philosophical in some ways because she emphasizes that your decisions should be based on conscious reflection on your principles.
Just going back to this first sentence, I found it quite striking how there is a clear sense of humbleness in the sense that it's not that she says that it should be like this and I'm going to tell you how it should be, but it's how I wish it could be, how I would like it to be. And I think that that's pretty rare in the literature.
Either because some people have a more, you know, instruction manual kind of style, like Taylor, you know, that's how the way it operates, you should follow it to the line. And or others have a more scientific excuse, the ones that we read from the Carnegie Mellon School, you know, they set up how things should be according to like proven science. She takes a completely different detour from all that. So I think that was very refreshing to have like this kind of text to discuss.
I also think that if you kind of like go to the final section, there's something a bit hidden, which is kind of like applying all these general principles also to her own job as a researcher, yeah, as an academic. So I don't know, I think it kind of like the circle closed itself with that final methodological of how I am approaching mm-hmm. my profession. So I found it very fascinating.
Yes.
I think it's interesting you talk about that circle, Miranda, because she actually talks about whether orders and situations are linear or circular mm-hmm. in the text earlier. And I think that circle idea that you bring out is consistent with her idea that so you need to integrate things through circular behavior, because it's not just I give an order and you do it, or I have these principles and I follow them. It's you take some action, you get feedback, you process the feedback, and then you use that again to either change your behavior or modify, you know, what your approach is. And so she's very much an advocate of that kind of circular behavior or approach. In a non, you know, a lot of people think, you know, circular reasoning as being, you know, inadequate. But in this case, I think she's talking about a kind of a process or of learning or a cycle of learning, as opposed to, you know, purely just a circle going over and over the same stuff.
This is very interesting, I think. And I just want to go back to this idea that Miranda was saying towards applying these ideas to her own work, because actually it's something that I didn't see in the text. I think it got away from me. I was thinking that when we read Taylor, I had the impression that what he was describing could be applied to the general, you know, manual worker. But it doesn't seem to be applied to the people that, the staff personnel that he's talking about, that's the one that are supposed to control the manual workers. So in a way, his principles apply to a certain category, but not work in general. And here we have a different thing in which she's setting up a method that's going to be applied to different kinds. It's much more general and much more democratic, if you will.
I think it's more than a method. If I can take us back to the very beginning, she gives an outline of what comes into the process of giving orders, and it's three different levels. The more conceptual one is the what she calls a conscious attitude, which is the principles. Then the one below is a responsible attitude, which is something like methods, I suppose, decide what to act upon. And the final is the experimental attitude, which is the implementation of, I guess, the principles in practice.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's where the circular part comes in, because it's that she said not only it's an experiment and watch the results, which I know you know that was implied, Dmitri. And then she actually adds a fourth step or fourth principle, and that is pooling the results, right? In other words, it's knowledge gets advanced not just because Ralph learns a few things and tries to practice them, but he compares his ideas with what Pedro has learned and what Miranda has learned and what Dmitri has learned, and then that's how these ideas can be carried forward.
More dissemination, because I understood that as analysis more than anything.
It's hard to say. It's not clear.
I think it's comparison, discussion, not really dissemination, but gathering more results from other experiences.
Yeah.
At least that's how I intended it.
Right. Well, one thing I struggle to understand is what is a situation? Like I can experientially, obviously, refer to a situation, but as far as this text goes, that she's framing the law of the situation as the way of coordinating work, but it's not really clear to me. Okay, on one hand, maybe I'm reading too much Whitehead lately, but...
Yes, it's bad for your head.
That's always a risk.
When you talk abstractly about the situation, that's all great. But if you think how to apply this conceptual framework onto the practical organization, then what is a situation? Where does it... Because I suspect he thinks of it this way. Then how does one ensure that this dynamic situation, and she does say that somewhere towards that order to be following the situation, because both are dynamic. Like, how do you ensure that? How do you use this as a practical management tool, I suppose?
I don't.
That is not clear to me. So I was hoping that you might help me understand what is the situation.
I don't want to be the philosophy party boomer, but I mean, it seems very straightforward to me. You know, managers and people in organizations like us, we are researchers. We can capture what's going on in the context, in the situation, in the scene of action, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's not only the individual, but what goes around the individual. So the hierarchy, the norms, the work that comes before and comes after, all that, I want to say, goes into the action to be taken. So I think it...
Right, but where do you discriminate between different situations? And
so let me give you some more perspective. I'm not necessarily going to explain it so much as tell you how it came across to me, and then we'll see if that is in the conversation. So when she's talking about the situation, what I gathered from that is basically, so that's a means to an end. And it looked very Tayloristic to me, where there's this idea that there's these facts on the ground, and and she actually refers to it in a couple of business cases where that the two different if people look rationally at the situation, that there wouldn't be any disagreement, and there would just be these facts, like an order goes up, or there's a problem in the quality of fabric, and she's not really clear about the fact that people have different perspectives and therefore they may disagree. But essentially, from the way she describes it, is very Tayloristic. You look at the data, and the data tells you this is going on. And the reason why that's a means to an end is that's not really what she's trying to get to. She's trying to get to orders and getting people that people would agree on what to do next. Therefore, orders would be largely unnecessary because people would have the same view of the situation, and therefore the action that would flow would be obvious. And so that it appears to me that's what she's talking about, that people could, two different observers could look at the same set of the situation, the facts, the collect data, and come to similar conclusions about what to do. And I share your concern, Dimitri, that it's hard to translate that into practical terms. Be like, how would you do that? If you, once you get beyond the, I need to move this box from here to there, or this fabric is the wrong color, or, you know, so I think there's certain situations that are largely, you know, based on, you know, is it raining or not, or how much is it raining, you know, those kinds of things. And I think it gets into difficulty when you get in more abstract and difficult decisions, such as, you know, would a user of a certain software program or electronic device want the button in this place, or how are they going to use that button? Now you get into things that are very socially determined and negotiated. And it may not be, so I'm almost done, but it may not be that the situation or law of the situation breaks down there. I think really what she's talking about is that I don't know if it's that people are going to have the exact same understanding of the situation, but what she's advocating is that managers and workers should discover it and then seek to make decisions based on that. So it's that integration of the perspectives, I think, is the most important thing, not that they exactly say, okay, we see this as black and white and everybody knows what to go do. I think it's more of a process. I don't know what you guys think.
I was listening to what Ralph was saying towards the end, and an example came right away to me from my fieldwork. But just before, I want to say something about this idea of situation, because I think it's interesting to think that what she was so adamant on was that she was going against what seemed to be very popular in her time, which what she called personality studies, which today could be typical neuroscience, cognitive science, whatever, all these attempts to boil down social beings to individuals that you can, you know, program, whatever. And she was pushing for a more context-based idea of how people behave in organizations. The example that came to mind to me was that many times when I was observing product managers in the company that I studied, it seemed that what we were trying to do was that they were trying to construct a common understanding about something, you know, because it was specifically important for these professionals, because since it was a matrix, they didn't have direct control on functional managers, but they had to somehow guide them towards the common goal of the project. And many times, I remember one case in particular in which they were trying to implement a new way to do interface management, and the leading product manager did not directly come up to the meeting and say, hey guys, we really have to do that. But he was telling stories of previous projects that they have done that faced a lot of trouble into this exactly point, and say, you know, it's time that we learn from our mistakes. Maybe we have the resources now to do it much better. Don't you agree that, you know, it's high time that we implement something? And by the end of the meeting, everyone was somehow convinced that they had to do something about that. So I think the reason why situations are a bit elusive is because it has to be constructed, as Ralph was saying, between managers and workers. And that's one of the roles of management.
Yeah, she says on page 33, something to this effect, one person should not give orders to another person, but both should agree to take their action from the situation.
Right, and that's why I think that's the science of the situation is a means to an end. It's not, that's, and I don't know, you know, I can't really say why she didn't go into more detail about that, But the whole point is goes back to what Pedro was saying, where she wanted managers or leaders or foremen to realize that employees were participants and you should include them in your assessment of the situation. And that relates very well to recent management theory that says management should share information with employees so they can, you know, they can make similar decisions. Because Fala talks all about the challenges of remote decision making, right? Making decisions from far away. She seems very skeptical of that. And there's a lot of that in current management theory. It says it's the people closest to the problem have the best data, the greatest knowledge, and therefore are best suited to make the decisions. And Taylor's similar, right? Where he said, study the work, make sure you know what the details of the work are, and therefore you can, you know, scientifically determine what the next thing to go do is. And I think Follett is similar in that way, where she's saying the management or the leadership should be engaging with employees to integrate their perspectives. Because just giving an order, she talks about just pure compliance isn't really what you want.
There are some interesting implications. One, I think that if you take this further, it does away with hierarchy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because not only does she say that what she's doing in this text is not trying to figure out how to make people obey orders, but rather how to integrate situations. And then later she says that she's not against authority, but she is for the authority of the situation. So I suppose if you kind of think that through right. to what you were just saying, is that the leadership and decision-making roles, they travel around a group of people depending on what kind of situation they find themselves in, which is almost anarchy.
Well, and in fact, she's criticized for that in some writings where it sounds like she's actually advocating that, and that's a, you know, we'd probably have to read a lot more of her work to understand it. But there's actually a quote I read in some of the other reading where they were talking to a line worker who was being told that they were going to get more information or it would be more integrative. They were, and I don't think it was Follett in particular, but some of her ideas. And the line worker's first response was, and I think Follett quotes this, first response is, oh, we won't need bosses anymore. I won't get bossed around by foreman anymore. So it's interesting. That was her first response, you know, when being told this. And so, yeah, it would seem that danger does exist.
Yeah, it was this girl she was quoting somewhere,
yeah,
I think,
yeah.
Towards the end.
It's very telling that she is considered a pioneer of empowerment research and participative leadership and all those things that have come after. So you can really see the seeds, and I think that's exactly what you all were saying. The thing is that I don't read it so much in anarchic terms, to be honest. I read it in a way, in a very current, if you will, way of thinking about work and management, in which we have today, what we have for many, many years, but you know, it's still going on today, this idea of the manager as a culture, not necessarily a control person, or agile. I know about a bit about product development methodologies and the ones that they apply for software, the agile ones. They insist a lot on this idea that the product manager is not necessarily there to control the tasks, but more to facilitate, you know. So I think it reflects more, you know, distributed, if you will, idea of management.
If I can build on this, I think one of the key aspects which is which struck me the most was that there's kind of like an implicit idea that all employees are equally intelligent, knowledgeable, worthwhile listening to. So while in Taylor's reading it was okay, yes, you have to study, and yes, but it's someone else making the decisions. Here, yes, there's an idea that you should listen to the employees because they are intelligent. They have something to tell you. They know something. Mm-hmm. And they could actually be... It's good to feel that they are acknowledged in their intelligence. And I think this is... I don't know. This is probably, if I could choose, the most important part I would take away from this reading.
I don't know if she goes as far as to... say intelligent, but
she
certainly thinks they're worth listening to. Yeah,
I felt it was there. I mean, completely the contrary of Taylor's reading, where he quotes, I think, was it a conversation with
Schmidt?
Yes, that's the one. A completely different feel, but we're in similar years, so I find it quite striking and fascinating.
Well, I think it also contrasts with Weber, right? Because he was all about hierarchy and orders and the flow, that you know, that all that kind of thing flowing in the organization, and she makes it more about, well, what do people know and how can they contribute and how do you integrate the diverse perspectives or approaches that they have. I mean, I think, and that's interesting that she seems to start from some of the same places as Taylor, but like you said, Miranda, she ends up differently, right? Because she talks about, Taylor says, well,
yes.
you just want compliance, right? Because you have these few people who understand and know the work. They know it scientifically, and Taylor's view of the workers is very dismissive. They don't understand. They don't know what to do. They can just take orders. And even though he felt mm-hmm. they should be consulted, so I think it's a bit of a contrast there. But in Follett's case, she's saying the workers have the knowledge and can do it just as well or be as knowledgeable. I think it's more like knowledgeable than work. You don't have to jump to intelligence, but I think it's okay to look at it that way. You know, knowledge of the work, intelligence of the work, to me it's the same. And I think it's fascinating that she ends up in this different place than Taylor did about worker motivation and how to the fact that she says, look, if you just give people straight orders, they're immediately going to resent you. I thought that was very interesting that there's this sort of a structural resentment built in if you just give orders and it's all about hierarchy and authority. So I thought that was a very good observation about her focus is really on integrating the workers' capabilities.
I think that's because she starts from a different assumption altogether, you know, and she has been the pioneer for, I don't know, human relations, social technical discussions from the top.
Absolutely.
But the thing is that I don't think that she has the same stand that someone like Taylor has, because, you know, everyone knows about Taylor, but we rarely hear about Mary Parker Follett.
Did you notice how, like, the idea of resentment of, like, not obeying orders is considered as a natural instinct? So it's not labeled in a very negative way. It's considered, like, something that is natural to us.
She says it's part of human nature.
Yeah.
Right? I thought it was very refreshing.
If you go back to Taylor, there's this idea that humans are lazy by nature. So it's quite negative. Here it's much more understanding, much more, I don't know, a feel much more accepting people's current nature.
I think Follett says that, or what she's basically saying is, the things that Taylor observed, or she would say, I guess, if I would say it, what I think she would say is, well, look, Taylor saw this resistance and this soldiering and this kind of stuff, and Follett would say, that's because it was all this top-down stuff. The foreman with the boss, they were the people giving all their orders, and so that was a natural reaction of the workers to what she calls bossism, which I love that word, bossism.
Yeah.
and so I think she goes deeper than Taylor. And because Taylor says, well, you can just take care of that by scientifically managing work and paying people more. And Follett is much more about integration of the diverse perspectives and bringing people together to understand the situation as a team. So I think it's an interesting approach to it.
I think the interesting bit is that I think there is almost like a cultural thing behind. Is that for Taylor, he starts the assumption that the workers are lazy. You know, if they resist an order, it's because they're lazy. But she's going to say that it's something, she doesn't say it, but I read it almost like individualism. You know, this idea that just because you want someone to do something doesn't mean that he's going to do. And I think the fact she was right in America has a lot to it. You know, if this was written in Japan, that would be a different kind of, you know, accepted way to behave at work, that people are more, you know, prone to be tolerant for order and structure and hierarchy, but she doesn't say it. It's just my reading.
I really enjoyed the example of the boy who was supposed to collect water from a well or something of that sort.
Oh, that was awesome! That was
and
awesome.
And he still does it, but it's like, but I'm not doing it because you told me to. It's because I acknowledged that it was necessary.
Yeah.
And I think
yes, exactly.
It's quite representative of this line of thought.
Yeah.
It seems from that example and others that people in 1920s were huge egomaniacs. I think this, one of the key distinctions between Follett and Taylor, well, one, of course, is the object of study, that Follett was interested in orders and Taylor was interested in efficiency. And of course, if you're Taylor and you look at 100 individual craftsmen who all do different ways and to different levels of efficiency, you would want to dictate, which is what he did, of course. Whereas if you're followed and you're looking at how people almost phenomenologically experience their work, so how is how they feel about it.
That's a good way to say it, phenomenologically, a phenomenological approach to work. I like that.
So then the situation becomes different. And she's basing her broad knowledge a lot in psychology, and I think Freudian psychoanalysis in particular. So there's a whole thing with the boy in the bucket of water that's extremely representative of that. That you don't tell me what to do, you know, I'll still do it because I'm thirsty or we need water, but who are you to tell me? There's a lot of that happening here, and that she's addressing and perhaps making more explicit than whether it's true to what it was back then.
I can tell you from a military perspective, one of the things you do when people first come in the military is you do socialize them into to lower their resistance to orders, right? In order to be told what to do, and in some professions of arms, that's more important than others, right? Because if someone's carrying a rifle in combat, you can't sit down and have a conversation about what's the best way. Although you do want to have the opportunity to have those kinds of conversations. So you almost want to, some people would say dehumanize, but you want to take that sort of natural resistance people have to orders and then create the ability to follow some orders without spending a lot of time with your ego on it. And what I found as a senior leader in the military is that, yeah, that was fine for getting people to show up at a certain time, wear a particular uniform, salute the right way, you know, those kinds of things, those kind of lower level thing, you know, characteristics of the organization. But when you wanted them to think about the best way to exercise, you know, do a procedure, or the best way to train somebody, or the best way to take notes, or best way to understand a topic, you couldn't do it that way. You can't go for compliance, and you have to be much more participative and find out, I think maybe as Follett would say in different language, you know, where they are. And you have to approach them that way, because you can't order people to be creative. And I think a lot of what Follett is talking is very applicable to knowledge organizations, because it's really not about compliance. And maybe even entrepreneurship is the same way, right? You really want to inspire creativity and ideas from people.
Before moving to knowledge work, I was dying actually to ask you that, Ralph, you know, from your experience in the military, because as I was reading about this whole situation and these more participative ideas, I was thinking that I think in the military, in some organizations, almost like the organization I study is a bit like that, because it's dealing with complex products. Not all levels of the hierarchy have access to the same amount of information on what is the general context and what's going on. So I was wondering, you said that you can get people and you can train people to respond to very simple basic commands, but you still need in more complex situations their input in a way. But does it complicate by the secrecy that exists in the organization, that you cannot just explain the whole context to the person?
Yes. Yeah, so it's complicated by secrecy and complexity, right? Because many times there's all these different moving parts going on, and explaining to people, you know, how getting them to focus on this particular part without bringing those other parts is very challenging. And you see a lot, many times people in the military will just ignore it, and they'll just skip over. So you get people will go, there's a famous public broadcasting, which is the U.S. equivalent of the BBC special on aircraft carrier, and it was going into war and to bomb people, and they talked to some of the, a lot of the focus was on the frontline workers. And there were several of them that said, I don't know why we're even doing this. I just know we're going here and we're doing our mission, but I don't know how this all fits. And I talked to people who were in the military who watched that, and they were furious. Not that the person didn't, you know, that the person said that, but that it was clear their leadership didn't even try to help them integrate and understand. But that's it, you know. And so I didn't get furious, because people have to make their own choices, and managers have lots going on. And yes, that is a challenge, because oftentimes it goes kind of back to what Miranda was talking about, or Dimitri's concern about anarchy, right? there's a limit in any organization by how much discretion you can give people. And you do eventually reach a point where someone's got all these great ideas or these things, they want to change stuff last minute. You're going to say, okay, look, that's a great idea. We don't have time to go execute that. We have to go down this path, but you want to feel like they contributed. And I used to have to explain to people, look, just because I don't do what you said doesn't mean I didn't listen to or value your input. Right? You have to have some conversations with people like that, because some get this idea, well, you didn't do what I said, so you don't care about what I said. And you, as a leader, you have to go to some lengths to say, to help them understand, no, it's not quite the same thing. I can't always use what you give me, but I'm able to use it another time.
So could we say that the principles and the methods behind the giving of orders work should actually be differentiated according to the type of activities? Because if there is one thing that I think is a strength of this text, but is also a weakness, is that to a certain extent it is quite too generic. Its nature is too broad. So yes, we do have examples belonging to the business world, but sometimes we actually miss the business world. We look into examples from family life, cases of boys going to fetch water, of obeying parents, of social workers choosing families for kids. At the same time, I found it extremely extremely strong as a way of describing the principles, but also weak, because I'm not sure the business world is always like that.
So that's a great point. I think it does vary based on the nature of the situation. For example, in the business world, there may be a certain process you use for asking for material or supplies or to lay out a project, like Pedro was talking about when you're starting a project. And you probably don't want to have I don't want to say debate, but a detailed assessment of the situation for how to do that every single time. Now there may be room to customize it when you say, well, what's the nature of the project? What are we trying to accomplish? But you don't, you can't say in a big organization, and in fact, you see this in the Navy all the time, where so I'll give you an example. They're going to build a new ship. And whenever you build a new ship, there's always a difference between what you was in the specification for the ship and what the shipbuilder is actually able to produce or build or weld or something like that. And the Navy's got an existing process that says, okay, well, we have a deviation from the specification. Here's how you document that and justify it and get approval. And then what you see regularly in the ship design programs, where they're actually designing, getting ready to build a ship, is they want to create their own name for this. They want to create their own process that's completely different from the rest of the Navy. And therefore, when the ship's delivered, you can't integrate this stuff. And it uses completely different paperwork that is foreign to people. And so you say, okay, great. I'm glad you guys want to be innovative, but there's no good reason to be completely different unless you can show me you can produce a completely different outcome than our existing process. We really should use the existing process. So I think, Miranda, I completely agree with you that some processes you ought to say, look, we're not going to – it is better just to follow orders and be very concrete about this. And then – and sure, if you got a suggestion of how to improve the process, we could consider that. But oftentimes, an individual worker doesn't know how the process is executed in 15 different departments and why it's done this sort of particular way. So at some point, you want to listen and say, okay, thanks for your input, but this is the process we're going to go use. And I think it's important. So I think follow is more focused on the process as opposed to the outcome. So you could say, yes, we valid your input, but this is the way we're going to go do it because it makes sense in these ways. As opposed to unquestioning, saying, "Well, okay, we don't really care what you think, and we're just going to do it this way." I mean, does that sound like a distinction?
That's one way of looking at it, and I think another one is that this asymmetry of information is also fundamental to building the actual situations within which these orders would be followed. Because what Miranda said, and then followed says on page 34 that we persons have relations with each other, but we should find them in and through the whole situation. To me, that says that relations, interpersonal and perhaps interorganizational, are rooted within situations, which means that the amount of information available to each party within the situation would determine the relation to one another, and altering that would possibly you know, unset the balance in the law of the situation. So with what Ralph was saying, and Pedro brought up, that within the military, it may be that lower rank are not even fully informed, or cannot be fully informed about the nature of the mission or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, had they been, because their take on the situation may be produced in a different way, the relations would be offset. So in more conventional terms, you would break the line of command, for instance.
Yeah, well, and I think your point about the asymmetry of information is fundamental, because I think we have to recognize that Follett is writing, was born in and writing in a time where work was much simpler and much more vertically integrated in firms than it is today. And that's a very real problem, this asymmetry of information. So, Dimitri, I think you've hit on something that's a I don't want to say a weakness, because it was just not the nature of the work that you saw, but you have to understand that when you're trying to say, okay, well, how do these relationships, how are they influenced by that? And I think you just have to recognize, yeah, that exists, but there's some things you can integrate and some others that are more difficult because of that asymmetry of information.
I didn't mean to qualify this as a critique, more of a property of the situations as she perceives them than anything.
Yeah, I agree. That's the way I saw it. It wasn't so much a critique as just it's the nature of how she saw them. Yeah, I agree.
I was going to say, but I'll just respond very quickly now, one thing. Maybe you capture maybe something I didn't capture, which is she's not only about managing the situation, but also managing the relations, if I understand you correctly. So, okay. But what I wanted to say is that we talked about knowledge work and the lack of examples that she has in the text, and whether she's talking more about the process or you know, a specific thing. I would be curious to know in what kind of industries she worked on, you know, because we know Taylor is typical manufacturing context. He's coming from there. And I don't know, Follett, if she worked in manufacturing, and it was more professional. I know that she acted as a management consultant or management guru for you know, all kinds of people. So it'd be interesting to see from which context does her reasoning come from, you know?
Yeah, so based on what I've read, it was social work, a lot of social work and community activity, community relations. And she didn't have a lot of experience in workplaces as a worker herself. She was born in a wealthy family, so she didn't have to work. She mostly spent her time as a student and educator. And so she did. Apparently, she did. She had some observations because she has these quotes in the text and stuff. As far as a worker in an organization, I think she had. Looks to me from the background material I saw, she didn't have much experience that way.
She went to Harvard, didn't she?
No, she. Well, I read that she went to Cambridge and she was not accepted in Harvard because she was a woman.
Oh yeah,
she wanted to go.
Yeah, that's right.
But that's interesting. So I was just going to say that confirms our supposition that you know what she's writing is much more in line to what we know today as knowledge work, because social work is made of different kind of professionals, you know, and so they're not producing something physical. They are dealing with other people and whatever, applying their expertise to situations.
Right, and thus her emphasis on relations, right? Because that's I think that's essential in social work, and I think it's a good thing. It's just that I think that's why. She kind of has that view of the more democratic view of the way organizations should be run, but you know I don't want to overanalyze her writings based on her experience. It's just that I could see how that might influence them.
Yeah, I agree. You probably shouldn't go ad hominem.
I'm trying to behave myself.
I have a devil advocate point. Should I make it now?
Yeah.
Okay. So we were saying before these things about how she is recognized as a pioneer in participative leadership. You know, Dimitri brought up the point of almost this anarchy, this idea of the extent that you can really integrate people in your decisions or not. And we had an interesting discussion on the case of the military and so on and so forth. But there were certain...
I'm sorry, before you continue, I feel it's important to note that we shouldn't get hung up on the word anarchy.
Okay.
Because... when I said that, it was a analogy more than a term.
Okay,
but,
sorry.
You know, carry on.
Okay, let's just call it more democratic. But there are certain points in which I think she's talking explicitly about impersonal control. You know, she refers to the situation as a way to achieve impersonal control, and he even refers to scientific management and the idea to depersonalize orders. And I know.
Oh yes, absolutely.
I know. When I was reading that, I was thinking about some discussions we had before in which we discussed the issue of surveillance at work. You know, from CCTV to email monitoring and all of those kind of different ways to exercise control on workers. And I was like, oh, you know, this situation is not necessarily one that is fuzzy and democratic and everyone together, but it's also about creating the conditions in which you can control people through other means than direct control. So,
absolutely. I don't know if the personalization of orders is part of the same parcel, because I think that mainly refers to not, you know, touching on people's egos. But other than that, manipulating situations through, as we discussed, either distributing information in an economical manner, intentionally or otherwise, or just building the situations in particular ways, and there are different ways to do that, which actually I think I didn't mention that, but it's very Marxian of her. It's almost as if the production conditions determine, at least in part, the attitudes and outcomes of individuals. Mm-hmm. So depending on how you design the conditions of work, you may determine, at least in part, how people will arrive at decisions and how they will resolve problems, which is very interesting, but she doesn't say anything from there. But yeah, I agree with you. I had hints of that as well while reading, that it's almost this normative control is the word.
Yeah, I just want to read the extract from page 33 that she says, "We have here, I think, one of the largest contributions of scientific management. It tends to depersonalize orders. From one point of view, one might call the essence of scientific management the attempt to find the law of the situation." So in a way, she has a common core with scientific management, which is...
Yes, well, and I love the quote that's a little later in that same paragraph, because I highlighted that one as well. she writes and further on, "Our job is not how to get people to obey orders, but how to devise methods." So there she's breaking with Taylor, right? Because it was about, we're going to follow orders and by paying them money and that sort of thing. But how to devise methods by which we can best discover, there's the pragmatist point of approach, the order integral to a particular situation, right? As if that's just kind of a merge. Right? So very optimistic and hopeful, I think. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not critiquing that. I'm just saying I think that's a very interesting quote.
Well, and this is where my confusion with what the situation is comes into play.
Yes, of course.
How does one create this? Is the situation the entire organizational disposition? So like the legal ownership structure, whether it's a partnership or a limited company or, you know, or a joint venture or whatever? Or is it a more micro thing, like a layout of the office? Or I think she's implicitly referring here to this idea that foremen would observe their employees, which she elaborates upon later on. So maybe putting more covert ways of observation, or removing observation, or ensuring observation by other means, you know, things like that. So that is basically how do you operationalize this form of giving orders?
Yeah, I'm with you. And she
I don't
goes
think
on
it's
the next
in the text,
page.
But it's something to discuss, certainly.
Yeah,
and she goes on the next page to say, she's just sort of hints at this difficulty I'm having with it. And she says, "The situation will often be seen differently, but often be interpreted differently," right? And so, okay, well, what do you do with that exactly? So, I felt unfulfilled a little bit, maybe is the best way to say it, you know, by reading it. But at least she's acknowledging that it exists. So I thought that was better than nothing.
That's all for part one. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying this episode so far, please let us know. Contact us on Twitter, Facebook, or on LinkedIn, or of course via our website. Leave us a positive review on iTunes, and tell your friends. We're always very happy to hear from our listeners, and now that you're getting in touch with us more often these days, then we're learning more about how to carry this podcast forward in a way that's enjoyable for all of us. If you want to learn more about future episodes or read a text version of a summary for this episode that I mentioned at the beginning, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and you'll find everything under the episode page. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you next week as we finish our conversation about Giving of Orders by Mary Parker Follett.